WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, writer Richard Ford, has a new novel called Independence Day that continues the story of Frank Bascom, the main character of Ford's acclaimed 1986 novel, The Sports Writer. Last week, our book critic Maureen Carrigan described The Sports Writer as one of the most moving books ever written about divorce and loss, and the nobility as well as the absurdity of just plodding along. In the new novel, Independence Day, Frank is no longer a sports writer, he's a real estate agent. His ex-wife has remarried, and his 15-year-old son appears to be turning into a delinquent. Maureen says she can't think of another American novelist besides Richard Ford who could write such an unsentimental, funny, and profound story about a man who's old enough to know better, regaining the courage to hope. In Independence Day, Frank is in his mid-40s, passing through what he describes as the existence period, the part of life that comes after the big struggle which led to the big blow-up, a period when we go along more or less self-directed and happy, but that is uneventful outside of small dramas and minor adjustments.
I was trying to describe a period of life when really you're just living your life, when you're not particularly attached to every drama that's going on around you, and when you're not undergoing a crisis. And I really, a time in life I think of as a kind of an okay time, maybe not the best time in your life, but an okay time, the time when most people are sort of unaware of their lives. And when I tried to think of what it was, I just thought of, well, it's the nature of existence. It's when we're just existing. We're not being driven crazy by anything, or we're not euphoric. And I didn't mean, and don't mean now, for that period of time, because it has that name attached to it, to be a doer time or an unhappy time.
Why did you decide to bring back Frank Bascom after your 1986 novel, A Sports Writer?
Because, and I certainly never intended to do it, I thought I had closed down all the sets on that last book and that he would speak no more. But in fact, in my notebooks in the years about 89, 90, 91, I found that I started writing in notes in my notebook in his voice. And I resisted a long time because I didn't particularly want to start thinking about a new book with Frank as its narrator again. But it just was the case that I kept looking at the world, in essence, through his fictive eyes. And finally, there was just a preponderance of notes in my notebook. And I had finished another book called Wildlife, and it was, in essence, finished out of my life. And I was sort of without work to do. I'd written two novellas, and I wanted to write a novel. And I looked around and saw what I had, and I had all of this stuff. And I resisted it for a year because I thought there were a lot of pitfalls to writing a sequel. And worked and worked and worked trying to see if I really had enough stuff. And it just finally became evident that I did have enough stuff. And that's kind of, you know, what Henry James used to call a done. I'm not sure if James exactly meant that, but I felt I was given all of this stuff. And that's what a writer has to start with, what you're given. And I was given a lot of material.
You said you kept hearing his voice. What are the qualities of Frank Bascom's voice?
Gee, that's a hard question. I'm not so sure I can itemize it. Well, I think it's intimate, for one thing. And I think it is a voice which likes to address what he thinks of. And I don't want to talk about him as though I didn't make him up, because I did. He didn't exist without me.
These
people who say about their own characters, well, my characters just speak to me. Well, that's a lot of baloney, actually. Writers write characters. That's how it works. But anyway, I think he has an intimacy in his voice, and I think he has a voice which likes to try to express affection, even if he doesn't always have the a handy language for it. I think he has in his voice an affection for language itself, so that he will use language sometimes for its sheer pleasures.
Frank was a sports writer in The Sports Writer, and now he's a realtor.
Right.
In your new book, seems to me that's an interesting profession to give a main character, because people are so hopeful and imaginative when they're buying a house. I mean, this house is either going to change their lives for the better or maybe ruin their lives with with the mortgage. So it's a situation in life when you're always imagining how this big decision is going to totally change the course of your life.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, finding shelter for people is, I think, one of the most primary things we can do for each other. And as the book stipulates, where a person buys a house determines where they'll be happy and where they'll be unhappy, and what windows they'll look out of, and where they'll come home after funerals and divorces and weddings and things like that. It seems to be sort of first principle for human happiness, where people live.
You know what I thought was interesting? Frank has a son in this book, a teenage son of 15, who has begun to go astray. The son has been arrested for shoplifting condoms, and he started fighting with the security guards when they tried to nail him. And this is the third book I've read this season by important writers who I really like, who have sons in the book that are going astray: Scott Spencer, Russell Banks, and yourself. And I wonder if you think that means anything.
I don't know, because I don't have any kids.
Well, I found that interesting too. That you'd be writing about a father so carefully, not being a father yourself.
Well, I guess. One of the things that interests me as a writer is families, and if you're going to write about families, you're constantly looking for sources of drama within families. And since I was kind of a bad kid myself and was more than once caught for shoplifting, it kind of came naturally to me to write about a kid who was shoplifting. I had some personal experience, and I also knew the distress it caused my parents for kids to get caught doing what they're not supposed to be doing like that. So even though it didn't happen to me as a father, it happened to me as a son, and so it was natural to come up into my mind.
One of the dilemmas Frank has, your main character, is that he wants to be this fountain of advice to his son, but he feels like he doesn't have the language. He doesn't know what to say, what advice to give. He's thinking of giving him some books to read.
Right.
That's probably a pretty common predicament.
Well, I'm happy to know that it's a common predicament. I suppose, in a sense, it was me acting out the predicament of facing what one actually would say to a child who was in some ways distressed and who was a little estranged from you. Trying to find the lingo myself led me, in a surrogate's way to some of the strategies of the book. Frank claims himself to be a liberal, and I think that's probably what, isn't that the old joke about liberals? Ask a liberal a question, he'll give you a book. Well, that's what he does. He gives his son a copy of the Declaration of Independence, and he gives his son a copy of Self-Reliance as a way of trying to open up a conversation, though it doesn't really work.
Independence Day is also a book about relationships between a man and his lover, who he's not sure quite how committed to he is, and a man and his ex-wife. And there's, some degree of talking about relationships in the book, which I think he's, reasonably reluctant to participate in. It seems to be the women who are more anxious to talk about it. Is that the kind of discussion you're also reluctant to get into in real life?
About relationships?
Yeah.
No, not at all. I think I've been married for, Christina and I have been married for 28 years. I think probably how life goes on intimately between the two of us is principally what we do talk about. We talk about life as shared between us all the time. No, I don't think I shy away from those kinds of conversations at all.
The question comes up in the novel, does Frank, the main character, does he know how to live, And do you feel like you know how to live? Do you have, like, that gift, that knack? Or do you feel like other people you've seen have it and you don't?
Myself, personally?
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of the old college phenomenon, in a sense, and maybe it gets exacerbated by ever having gone to graduate school. You constantly think that life is one place and you're someplace else, that you're always waiting to start life, and life is just kind of a little bit offshore. But as for myself, whether I know how to live life personally or not, I at least will agree to you that I'm living it. Which is, I don't think that I'm not living it, or I don't think that the good life or the engaged life is someplace else from where I am. I mean, I'm spending my life trying to be a good writer and writing books, and so I'm very much nose up to my life in that sense. And I think Christina and I, and I know she is too, but I think we both feel like we're sort of very close to the nap of our lives, which has nothing to do with whether or not we're successful at living it, or whether it makes us ecstatic day to day, year in, year out. But I think I'm living it. It would have to be probably in the words of somebody else to know if I'm doing it good or not.
My guest is Richard Ford. He has a new novel called Independence Day. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Richard Ford is my guest. He has a new novel. It's called Independence Day, and it's a sequel to his 1986 novel, The Sports Writer. Your father, I think he died when you were about 16.
Right.
I know during some of his life he was a salesman. I believe he sold starch.
Exactly.
On the road. Was he the kind of salesman who had to survive on his verbal skills to convince his clients to buy something, or was he not that kind of salesman?
Well, that's a funny thing you should ask, because he used to, part of his territory was down in what they used to call the Evangeline Country, which is over on the west side of the Atchafalaya River in Louisiana, and where in the 50s at least, and probably still today, people spoke French, and that patois French, and he would go into these little towns like Thibodeau and Ville Platte and St. Francisville, and he would go in there, and I think kind of sell himself to people who he didn't share a language with, but I think he would kind of fake it sometimes. He would sort of speak to them in a patois of his own, and they would speak back to him. And basically, what he did was sell himself to them by not so much his verbal skills, but by his willingness to try.
Did you ever watch him in action on the road?
Many times. Many times. In fact, I can still drive over there, particularly also up in the Delta in Mississippi, where I sometimes live. I can go back to those places where he traveled, and he used to take me inside these wholesale grocery company warehouses, and I would just stand beside him as he would do his business. And I can go back to those places now. There, some of them are still around. It's quite memorable to me.
What was it like growing up knowing that your father sold starch? I mean, starch isn't a really big part of a young person's life.
Starch is not too sexy.
No.
Well, it was the only job he ever had. And we thought, my family used to always say that my father was a guy who had a job during the Depression. He got a job working for the same company, the Faultless Starch Company in Kansas City, Missouri, the same company that Huey Long used to sell starch for in the 20s. And they were always so thrilled, my mother and father, that he had kept his job through the 30s and through the 40s and through the 50s. And the fact that he sold starch rather than, something more high profile or appealing never was an issue in our life at all. I think maybe amongst his salesman pals, there was a lot of joking about starch. You know, there's salesmen. I guess the idea of a traveling salesman joke doesn't exist anymore. But I'm sure there were a lot of nice bawdy jokes about selling starch, and you can imagine.
I can see where you're leading.
You can imagine,
yes,
what they would be about. I think that was a source of humor. My father was a very mirthful guy, and so I think he thought selling starch was his job. And he came out of a time in American life when, if you had a job, you didn't question what kind. Upward mobility was not really a matter of choosing among a lot of alternatives. He had a job. He loved it. He worked hard at it, and that was it. I think, in a way, frankly, that has led me to some of the preoccupations of my own work, which is not surprising. A character really doesn't become workable for me, and I don't want to say real, because characters never really become real for me, but a character doesn't become workable for me until I can posit what it is she or he does for a living.
Mm-hmm.
And once I get that little anchorage established in a character's the sort of fascicle of life that they have, then I can begin to imagine them more completely.
When your father died when you were 16, did you become like a more responsible person then, or did you get into more trouble in the short period right afterwards?
No, I had been in a lot of trouble in the short periods just before, and it's a very peculiar thing in a sense. I had gotten in trouble with the police for stealing with a pal of mine in Little Rock, or rather in Jackson, where I grew up, Mississippi. And my father was a traveling salesman, and so he was gone a lot and come home on the weekends. And my mother always tried to make the weekends be rather nice, and the affairs of daily life were sort of set aside while my father was home. But when I got in trouble with the police, my father had to come along and take an interest in this. And he was, I remember, so kind about it. He said to me, "Well," he said, "you'll." This is bad, and you're going to have to be on probation, you got to go to court and things like that. And but I remember very distinctly, and my mother was the same. I don't want to include her out of this, but he was extremely sympathetic to me. He sort of seemed to know that what I was doing was not good, that it wasn't the worst thing. And then 2 weeks after this happened, he died. And that's what it left me with, his death. It left me with a sort of conviction that I had to do more right than I had been doing up to date. And so I actually kind of started getting my act together, because my mother said to me after my father died, she said, "I'm going to have to go to work now. You're 16 years old. You're going to have to take care of yourself a lot more than you've been taking care of yourself." And so that was true. I knew it was true. And so I did.
Did you have to get a job?
Well, I had a job.
Uh-huh.
We worked.
What'd you do?
Oh, I sat groceries at the A&P, and I did all the things that boys could do in those days. I did everything that I could do to earn some money. I mean, and I don't want to misrepresent our life. It wasn't that we were poor, because we weren't, but it would have never occurred to me, nor would it have ever occurred to my family, that when I got above 14, which was the age when you could go to work, that I wouldn't have a job. I just did.
I know you spent some time, I guess maybe this was after your father's death, living with your grandparents.
Right.
Who, did they own a motel or run a motel?
They ran a big hotel in Little Rock. And after my father died, quite a while before he died, because he had been sick with heart trouble for years before that, I spent a lot of my growing up period, particularly in the summers, in the Marion Hotel in Little Rock, Arkansas. And for for a period of adolescence, that's quite a risque place to grow up.
Did were risque because there's a lot of people who go there for their quickie afternoon flings? Or?
That and just a lot of general license occurs in a hotel. It was a big hotel. It's gone now. They imploded it in Little Rock back about 20 years ago. They wouldn't do it now because it was a wonderful old building. But all kinds of political shenanigans and, the quick afternoon stop off. But, also a good deal of violence. People going into hotel rooms and committing murders, and going into hotel rooms committing suicides, fights, all kinds of mayhem.
Well, this must have made you think that life was very eventful.
Yes, it did, actually. And I loved it. Consequently, I loved to go there. Every time I could get a chance, I would go up to Little Rock and stay with my grandparents, because you never could tell what was going to happen.
What I find particularly intriguing about this is that one of the things I've always liked about hotels and motels is that, at their best, they're a way to get some respite from regular life. You're in this kind of limbo, and someone comes in and cleans your room and makes the bed. All the responsibilities that come with having an apartment or a house, you don't have while you're in this hotel.
That's exactly right.
And you're probably removed from everything else in your life also, unless you're at a business conference.
That's exactly right.
So to live in that environment where everybody around you has gotten away from regular life, but that is your regular life, is pretty interesting.
Well, it creates in you a kind of dual sense of permanence and transience, equally competing for persuasive power in your life.
Right.
And it did me, in fact. I mean, I don't know if there's any time in the life that I'm happier than the first 25 minutes after I've checked into a hotel. as you say, all of those things that you just described, all of those senses of irresponsibility and come down on you wonderfully. Christina and I think that one of the things that we do is in Montana is that we go hunting sometimes, and we just stay in little cheap motels way out in the middle of nowhere, and I think it's the happiest we ever are for the very reasons that you say.
Now, did you have a writer's interest in imagining the lives of all the people staying at the hotel while you were there?
Well, I didn't have to imagine it.
Right.
I was the manager's son.
Oh,
I could,
right.
If I wanted to know what they were doing, I could jolly well find out what they were doing, because I knew all the bellboys. I knew all the maids. One of my first jobs was to be a room service waiter. And can you imagine what a 17-year-old room service waiter sees?
What do you see?
Well, you see the governor sometimes where he's not supposed to be. You see the head of the highway patrol sometimes where he's not supposed to be. And it was always strange, because this was not even in my grandfather's hotel, but another hotel. I really grew up in the hotel business in that sense. And I was kind of a naive kid in some ways, and I would sometimes take somebody's breakfast to their rooms, and the man who opened the door would be a man I knew. And maybe he wouldn't recognize me right away as being the kid with the white jacket on. But something in me always made him say, "Oh, hi, Mr. So-and-so. Remember me? I'm Richard Ford. I'm Ben Shelley's grandson." And there was always kind of an awful moment, which I finally, by dint of repetition, quit doing. But I couldn't resist when I saw somebody I recognized saying hello and introducing myself. I guess I'm my father's son in that way.
Did you know the meaning of the word discretion when when you were at the hotel?
No, I didn't know. But I learned it, though.
Did the people ever pay you not to say anything?
No. No. They may have wished they had later, when they saw books that I wrote 25 years later, in which their lives were perhaps reflected. Though I never used anybody's name. Yes, I learned discretion.
Richard Ford, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure entirely.
Richard Ford, his new novel is called Independence Day. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.